I'd like to welcome you to the 2010 Iraq lecture. So these lectures are a kind of joint activity of DAOGP and St John's College, and I'd like to extend a particular welcome to the fellows and members of St John's here. These lectures have been going on, I mean, almost every year since 1986, when I think the first lecture was final, and we've had a very interesting lectures by distinguished historical physicists over the years. And today our lecturer is Professor Leo Kadanoff, and my colleague Michael Green is going to introduce.
Well, I'm just going to say a few words by way of introduction. For those of you particularly who don't know about Leo Kadanoff's work, he's very celebrated within our community in particle physics, even though he's not a member of that community, because his work has had such widespread influence. He's most well known amongst us for work in the mid to late 60s, on statistical mechanics, critical phenomena, and its connection with renormalization theory. And so his deep understanding of correlation functions in near-critical systems led to a complete transformation of ideas in quantum field theory in particular. And since that time, that understanding has proved particularly influential in many, many aspects of work in many areas of theoretical physics. So his expertise transcends the particular expertise of any group within our department, and I think it's probably influenced most of us in some way or another. And so it's a great pleasure to have him here. He's recipient of many awards, among them the Wolf Prize in 1980, the Boltzmann Medal, the Onsager Prize at the APS, the National Medal of Science, Grand Medaille d'Or, the French Academy of Sciences, and many others. Currently, he's a MacArthur Distinguished Service Professor of Physics and Maths at the University of Chicago, and the theme of his talk doesn't require any more introductions. Welcome, Professor Kadanoff.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. I'm going to be talking about phase transitions. So this picture, which shows three different phases of water, is rather appropriate. Dirac wrote a paper ages ago on renormalization in classical electrodynamics. Dirac thought about renormalization ideas and said about them, "I might have thought that the new ideas were correct had they not been so ugly." I am going to be trying to argue that the ideas were not ugly. I don't expect, for a variety of reasons, to convince Dirac of anything. However, I hope to have moderately persuasive arguments. I will read this and then try to ad lib thereafter. By reading, you can then begin to understand my regional accent. In present-day physics, the renormalization method, as developed by Kenneth Wilson, serves as the primary means for constructing connections between theories at different length scales. This method is rooted in both particle physics and the theory of phase transitions. It was developed to supplement mean field theories like those developed by van der Waals and Landau. Content is that sharp phase transitions are necessarily connected with singularities in statistical mechanics, and these singularities in turn require infinite systems for their realization. I call this result the extended singularity theorem. A discussion of this point apparently marked a 1937 meeting in Amsterdam celebrating the centenary of the birth of van der Waals. Mean field theories, like those of van der Waals and Landau, neither demand nor employ spatial infinities in their description of phase transitions. Another theory is required that weds a breaking of internal symmetries with a proper description of spatial infinities. The renormalization semi-group provides such a wedding. I'll describe its nature. I'll describe the major ideas surrounding this point of view, especially scaling, universality, and the development of connections in physics among different kinds of theories. I'm a condensed matter theorist with an interest in the history of science, and I intend to talk about a subject closely related to condensed matter, but also to the philosophy of science and to particle physics. I'm not an expert in either of the latter subjects. Nonetheless, I will try to tell you something about them. Those of you who are more expert than I will be better able to appreciate whether what I'm saying is correct or false. Am I talking at the right level of volume for the?
Yeah.
Yes, fine. Condensed matter physics. The formulations of what we do in condensed matter physics are clear. The basic stuff was set up by the statistical mechanics of Boltzmann and Gibbs and the Schrodinger equation. We understand about those roots of our subject. Our goal is to explain the amazing variety of nature. We sort of look at nature like as like an onion, which we expose layer after layer as we describe what we see. We hope to see mathematical and conceptual beauty arise based upon a deep understanding of the many mundane phenomena around us. In practice, condensed matter physics is polytheistic in that we look at many different problems, many different points of view at the same time. Particle physics starts out with relatively simple results, the masses and cross-sections of particles. Its goal is to seek a clear and perhaps final theoretical formulation based upon experiments and observations. So it hopes to see mundane phenomena like the masses and cross-sections produce the mathematical beauty of a single truth. In that sense, particle physics is more monotheistic than polytheistic. The philosophy of science has worried a lot about the connections between different theories. Condensed matter physics relates the observable, often macroscopic properties of liquids, gases, solids, and all everyday materials to all more microscopic theories, often the quantum theories of atoms and molecules. Since the macroscopic theories are themselves interesting and non-trivial, that is, subjects like elasticity and hydrodynamics and the electrodynamics of materials, it follows that condensed matter physics is largely an exercise in connecting different kinds of theories. Typically, this involves different length scales, going perhaps from the size of atoms and molecules to the size of a physical laboratory. One of the deepest aspects of this area of science is the existence of different thermodynamic phases, each with qualitatively different properties. Freezing, for example, is a sudden qualitative change in which the material abruptly gains rigidity. Solid water is not like liquid water. It has a qualitative difference in its behavior. Particle physics is also concerned with connections. Particle physics often wishes to relate the present phenomenological theory, always has a present phenomenological theory, which it wishes to relate to a deeper theory of at shorter or perhaps at longer length scales. It wants to connect at this moment, for example, the Standard Model to physics at a unification or a Planck scale. Previously, the search for a final theory in particle physics has been impeded by singularities apparently arising in the theory at scales far shorter than the scales of observation. These singularities show up directly as infinities in perturbation calculations and indirectly as algebraic behavior, as 1 over the space-time distance to a power in correlation functions, or in Schwinger functions, as they're called. I'm going to follow the logic and arguments of condensed matter physics for most of this talk, but I'm intensely aware of the applications to particle physics. Field theory and statistical mechanics are closely connected. A Wick rotation in which the time goes into the square root of minus 1 divided by the Boltzmann constant times the temperature will take you from one kind of theory to another. In addition, quantum mechanics and classical mechanics are closely connected also. Both employ Hamiltonians as their basic generators of time development, as do field theory and statistical mechanics. All four of the theories listed in blue have a dual structure in which terms of the Hamiltonian both describe measurable quantities and equally generate changes in how time development occurs. All four have the same structure involving brackets, Poisson brackets or commutators, conjugate variables, that is, P's and Q's. I'll talk mostly about statistical mechanics. These connections that you see in front of you were followed by Dirac, and we followed Dirac's ideas in thinking about these connections. Statistical mechanics was defined in the 1860s or 70s by Maxwell, whom I needn't tell you about, and Boltzmann, whom I also needn't tell you about. These gentlemen stated that the probability for finding an equilibrium system in a volume element d gamma about some place gamma in phase space, that is, space of p's and q's, momenta and positions, was given by d gamma, the volume element, times an exponential of minus 1 over kt times the Hamiltonian, that is the energy expressed as a function of phase space, minus the free energy which serves as a normalizing factor. That normalizing factor is then given as an integral over phase space of e to the minus beta times the Hamiltonian. This integral covers all configurations of the system. Thus, the free energy is proportional to a logarithm of a sum or an integral of exponentials with weights which are positive numbers, one in effect. For a system that is finite in extent, such a sum or an integral is always a smooth, that is, real analytic function of the arguments in the Hamiltonian. Consequently, if you have a finite system, that finite system cannot possibly have a phase transition, which is a change in the structure of the free energy. Phase transitions necessarily involve this thing producing singularities, and that only occurs in infinite systems. That's, in essence, the content of my talk, and it's a simple content. It is something that you can follow on one slide, or you can look up in Wikipedia. A phase transition appears as a sharp change in the form of thermodynamic functions, a change as you go from water in the liquid form, which sloshes around, to water in the solid form, as in this snowflake. A singularity, as I said before, will not happen in any finite system, as in a finite liquid. The singularity can and does happen in an infinite system. I call this result the extended singularity theorem. This theorem has been extensively used but has not really been extensively discussed in the literature. It follows that any proper description of a phase transition requires a theory which makes explicit use of the infinite size of the system. Most theories constructed before Kenneth Wilson's renormalization group theory of 1971 fail this test. I'm going to go back and give you some history, history that you may have learned in high school or college or some other place, very familiar history. In 1869, Thomas Andrews experimentally studied the pressure of pressure volume diagram of carbon dioxide. He discovered what is now called the critical point. His data look roughly like these. These curves show what are called isotherms, that is, pressure versus volume relations at constant temperature. This cartoon is a PVT plot, pressure, volume, temperature plot for water, but carbon dioxide is basically similar. Notice the points of singularity in this picture. When the water starts to boil here, you have a sharp corner. What happens is that if you start at high pressures and increase the volume, the pressure goes down and down until you reach the boiling point. At the boiling point, the pressure remains constant for a while the volume increases. Then you finally reach a situation in which you have a pure vapor phase. That vapor phase then continues down in pressure from there on. That happens at this temperature and this higher temperature. At this critical temperature, the discontinuity between liquid and vapor disappears. And above this critical temperature, you have smooth isotherms in which there is no distinction between liquid and vapor. These qualitative changes that I just talked about, this change at TC, the change at the beginning and end of boiling, are the mathematical singularities that are the subject of this talk. In 1873, van der Waals derived an approximate equation of state for fluids. I plot the approximate equation of state as a function of pressure divided by critical pressure, volume divided by critical volume. The critical point, which is a place where the isotherm becomes flat, is given here. These curves are isotherms again. He started from the perfect gas law, PV is NKT, and then derived a correction based upon two coefficients, which were properties of molecules. This coefficient, B, took into account the finite volume of a molecule. This coefficient, A, took into account the attractive force between molecules. Notice that this work has no boiling, no singularity of that kind in it. There's no reference to the infinite size of any system in van der Waals' work, and essentially no singularities there. But van der Waals' result was not stable. If you have a situation in which the pressure increases as the volume goes up, that's a mechanical instability, and the whole system will do something at that point. Maxwell looked at that mechanical instability, added some information about thermodynamic instability, and suggested a modified phase diagram. The modified phase diagram looks like this. It includes boiling, and it includes a qualitative picture, which is the same as the one we use today. A little later, Pierre Curie and Pierre Weiss put together a theory of ferromagnetism based upon ideas very similar to the mean field theory that van der Waals had put together and the thermodynamic arguments of Maxwell. Following upon that, there were literally dozens of different mean field theories developed to describe different phase transitions, all of which were sort of qualitatively similar, and qualitatively similar to what you see in front of you. I hop forward in time to 1937, to a statistical mechanics conference, which was held in Amsterdam to celebrate the centennial of van der Waals' birth. At that conference, there were a bunch of famous and accomplished people, including Debye, Uhlenbeck, and Kramers. Kramers was chair of a session, and in that session, they discussed the pictures that I show before you and I have shown before. These pictures include a liquid region and a vapor region, and there is a mixed state in which liquid and vapor exist together. Now, these pictures are, of course, different. In this picture, you have Maxwell's addition of the singularities. This picture is inconsistent with the statistical mechanics of any finite. This picture is inconsistent with the statistical mechanics of any finite system. What have we lost here? Okay. Something my computer did, perhaps. Okay, excuse me, let me recompose myself. I became discomposed. This picture is inconsistent with the statistical mechanics of any finite system. This picture is inconsistent with our most elementary knowledge about liquids. Then the conference was perplexed by this pair of inconsistencies. They discussed it, and finally they decided to vote on a proposition. That's, of course, how you solve things in physics. You all get together and vote on what's right. And the proposition they voted on is whether statistical mechanics could describe this liquid region. The reason for that is that they knew statistical mechanics could describe this region of vapor because there had been successful theories. There had been fewer successful theories in this region. And the vote came out 50-50 with Debye voting nay. The answer, nay, is wrong. Liquids are described by statistical mechanics, as we see from wonderfully successful theories that work today. What's the truth of this all? Well, I think, the truth on the next slide. Come on, fella. Okay. As I've been saying, thermodynamic phase transitions involve singularities and infinities arising almost always from an unbounded number of particles. These infinities appear in thermodynamic derivatives, and they're caused by a correlation length, a coherence length, that diverges as we approach these points, and especially as we approach the critical point. In practice, the correlation length, the coherence length, describes the spatial extent of fluctuations within the system. These fluctuations look like the wrong phase occurring in the system or mixtures, drops of the different phases. The divergence in the correlation length makes the extended singularity theorem work. Statistical mechanics does indeed fail, but not in this liquid region. Instead, statistical mechanics fails in the boiling region. The boiling region has in it large fluctuations, huge droplets, hydrodynamic things of complicated nature, is affected by surface tension and affected by gravitational forces. It is rather too messy for statistical mechanics. It is also true that the approximate theory put together by van der Waals must be improved near the critical point. The theories available in 1937 were simply no good near the critical point. The finite size of real systems cuts off the infinities and makes the infinities not occur as sharply as they would otherwise. There is some rounding here. The thermodynamic derivatives get very large here, but they don't diverge. As I said, the statistical mechanics does fail in the boiling region. Even as far back as 1937, there was evidence of divergent fluctuations near the critical point. The evidence was in the form of a physical effect called critical opalescence. As a fluid is brought near its critical point, well, fluid is transparent. As a fluid is brought near its critical point, it becomes cloudy. Light doesn't go through it in the same way. Schmalkowski and then Einstein argued that this cloudiness was produced by fluctuations in the density of the fluid, which in turn produced scattering of light, and these fluctuations would diverge at the critical point, causing a divergence in the compressibility of the fluid. A little later, Ornstein and Zernike, in 1914 and 1916, argued that it was not the magnitude of the fluctuations that diverged. Instead, the range over which the fluctuations were correlated, called C, would diverge as the critical point was approached. This so-called correlation length would become infinitely large. The density at two different points in the fluid would have a form in which it would fall off as the distance divided by C, and that fall off would disappear as the critical point was approached because C would go to infinity. How could these divergences occur? Well, mean field theory got them roughly right, as I'm going to show you in the next slide, but not quantitatively right, only sort of qualitatively right. The divergences in the critical region are traditionally described in terms of power laws in which things diverge as powers of the appropriate parameters. In this case, the appropriate parameters are small t, which is temperature minus critical temperature, and small h, which is pressure minus critical pressure. For example, in critical opalescence, the compressibility diverges as t to the minus gamma. Mean field theory gives gamma equals 1. In two dimensions, we know the value of gamma from the Ansager solution of what is called the Ising model. I'll tell you more about it in a moment. And in three dimensions, we know the value of gamma from numerical observations. They differ from the mean field theory value. For the coherence length also diverges with an index which is given incorrectly by mean field theory. And that's what I want you to get out of this slide. There is more. Before I go into the more troubles with mean field theory, I should tell you when mean field theory works. You all have studied, or many of you have studied, the electrodynamics of a continuous media. You know that it is described by fields E, D, B, and H. The fields E and B include, in addition to the fields produced outside the material, the fields produced outside the material are called D and H. The fields E and B include, in addition, the averaged effects of charges and currents within the material. This kind of mean field theory works wonderfully well because there are zillions of electrons in the material. The averaging that goes with mean field theory works very well indeed, at least for macroscopic-sized materials. In nanoscopic theories, that is, in theories of very small materials, mean field theory fails, and we can no longer use the electrodynamics of continuous media. I promised to tell you a little bit about the Ising model. The Ising model is a model of ferromagnetism, or of liquid gas phase transitions. Here I'm going to describe it in terms of liquid gas phase transitions. At every point in a lattice, the Ising model has a lattice, there's a variable called sigma r, which takes on one of two possible values, say plus or minus 1. Plus 1 describes a region of high density, minus 1 describes a region of low density, and the Hamiltonian is set up so that nearest neighbor sites, this is a sum over nearest neighbors, so that nearest neighbor sites should have the same density. That is the more probable thing. That is the thing that gives us lower energies. The H, which is pressure minus critical pressure, or chemical potential minus the critical value of that, controls the average density of the system. You calculate the free energy by the sum over all configurations of e to the minus beta times this H. and you then get a free energy which you can use to understand the phase transition between liquid and gas, which I have already talked about. The important thing to notice is that this model can have an ordering in which liquid regions extend over very large distances if the temperature is very low, and that occurs if K is large. So mean field theory has some problems. I started telling you about them. One kind of problem is that it's useless in predicting phase transitions and ordering over long distances. For example, mean field theory predicts phase transitions in one-dimensional systems. You never see a phase transition in any one-dimensional system. If you take two dimensions, you can think of three different kinds of ferromagnets. One is what is called a single-axis ferromagnet, in which the magnetism has been pointed in one of two directions. That's an Ising model. Another is what's called an XY model, in which the magnetism can point in a plane. A third is a Heisenberg model, in which the magnetization can point in any direction in three-dimensional space. These three cases are different. These three cases, you have a phase transition plus long-range order in the Ising model. In the XY model, you have a phase transition but no long-range order. In the Heisenberg model, you have no phase transition. Mean field theory predicts the same behavior for all three of these. That's bad news. That suggests that mean field theory is not giving us what it should. One more piece of bad news. Here's a picture of the mean field theory prediction for the specific heat. That is the second derivative of the free energy with respect to temperature in the neighborhood of the critical point. Here are measurements due to Moldover and Little of that specific heat. As you can see, the specific heat grows and, in fact, seems to go to infinity at the critical point in this phase liquid gas phase transition of helium-4, liquid gas phase transition of helium-3, superfluid phase transition of helium-4. These behaviors with infinities are qualitatively different from things predicted by mean field theory, and they are qualitatively different because the mean field theory takes into account the average results and the physics is in the fluctuations. The physics is in the correlation length, and the correlation length describes the correlations among fluctuations in the system. These fluctuations are droplets of fluid, and at the critical point, these droplets are correlated over infinitely large distances. So I'm talking about theoretical physics, and so I'm going to be talking in a second about the renormalization theory put together by Kenneth Wilson. Precursors to this theory were Ansager's solution of the two-dimensional Ising model. His results disagreed with mean field theory. The results of the King's College School, that is, well, you know about the King's College School, it's just down the street, sort of. This group of people did expansions in the coupling and the exponential of minus the coupling in high temperatures and low temperatures, and they found critical indices like the ones I showed you on the slide. They found that the mean field theory critical indices were wrong and that they could get consistent answers. That is, on different lattices, they saw basically the same value of the critical indices, the same value if the dimension was held constant, but the kind of lattice was changed. This result is what we now call universality. Universality is the result that different phase transitions have the same critical indices and the same critical behavior. In fact, near the critical point, everything is the same. In Novosibirsk, Patashinsky and Pokrovsky calculated the structure of correlation functions. They didn't get the critical indices right for the correlation functions, but indeed they got the form of the correlation functions qualitatively correct. I'm going to talk in more detail about the work of Ben Widmer and myself. Ben noticed the most significant properties of near the critical point. These properties were connected with the sizes of things, the so-called scaling behavior. Once again, we use the variables T and H. He focused attention on scaling near the critical point. In this region, the averages and fluctuations have a characteristic size dependent on these two variables. For example, when H is equal to zero and we're below the critical temperature, there is a jump in density in the liquid proportional to temperature minus critical temperature to the power beta. If we set the temperature equal to the critical temperature and look at the dependence of this density minus critical density, it depends on H to a power. That power is 1 over delta. He looked up, measured, and found out something about these powers. But more important, he noticed that there would be a characteristic size of the H of pressure minus critical pressure in terms of temperature minus critical temperature. This characteristic size was determined by setting these two orders of magnitude equal, and you got a characteristic size of minus T to the delta, where capital delta is beta times small delta. He then said, given that characteristic size, density minus critical density would be T to the minus beta, this term, times some function of H divided by its characteristic size, and use that to integrate and get the free energy near the critical point as a non-singular term plus terms which were singular, whose structure he could then calculate. He then calculated all of the divergences and all of the possible thermodynamic quantities and came out with stuff that agreed very well with the experimental behavior. These magic results were there for me to look at when I was thinking about what was the structure of the behavior near the critical point. I said to myself, well, I know that the correlations extend over an infinite distance. I know that the distance, that all scales are important. Why don't I think about the effect of changing scales in the neighborhood of the critical point? So here's an Ising model, a model in which you have arrows which describe high density and low density. Those arrows are placed on a two-dimensional lattice. And then imagine that we take a region of the lattice, a region containing 9 of these variables, and we represent that region by an average variable, a block variable, which points in the same direction as the preponderance of these variables, or as the majority of these variables. This kind of election process is done through the entire lattice, and we then get an effective value of a new variable, which I called mu, a new variable, which I thought of as being part of a new description of the system in terms of an Ising model. This new variable would have a new, this new description would have a new value of T minus TC and a new value of P minus PC, and these would be proportional to the old values with a constant proportionality, which was proportional to the size of the cell to a power. The number of lattice sites would also change. The number of lattice sites would be decreased by a factor of the size of the cell to the dimension of the system. Then the next step was to demand that this change in length scale would produce no change whatsoever in the theoretical description. That you will recognize as a demand that the system had some scale invariance. That then was used in order to get scalar coefficients. For example, coefficients which did not change as the length scale changed. The combination h over t to this power does not change as the length scale changes. And the coherence length is if the coherence length appears as a lattice constant, that is the distance between the variables, divided by t to this power, that would remain unchanged as we varied L. That demand of invariance reproduced the phenomenological results of Whittem and produced a sort of heuristic theory. This heuristic theory, I couldn't figure out the values of the coefficients L sub h and L sub t, but I could talk about the structure of the theory and essentially got it right. That is, I got the scaling properties correct, and as you'll see in a little bit, the universality was correct. Heuristic theories aren't as good as real theories. 5 years after the heuristic theory, Wilson put it all together and got a real theory. He did that by making three important changes in what I had done. I considered, as you saw, two of the possible couplings. Wilson considered simultaneously all the possible couplings that could occur in the system, nearest neighbors and next nearest neighbors, everything that you could have. He considered not one renormalization transformation, not one transformation in which you change the length, but a whole succession of them, as in the earlier work of Gell-Mann and Lowe. You don't then have to guess where the renormalization will take you. As I had to guess, you just follow it through. You eventually reach what is called the fixed point, and the fixed point is what I'm going to be talking about in the next few slides. So you continue the changes in the length scale. You multiply the length by a factor of 3, say, and you do that again and again and again until you reach a situation in which the couplings don't change anymore. This you can have this happen by doing a large number of transformations in a system which is effectively infinite, or you take a finite system and you go far enough away in a finite system, you do enough transformations, you've eaten up all the coupling constants, there are no couplings left, and it's a weak coupling problem. There are then three possible outcomes. You can have the couplings go to infinity. This is called a strong coupling fixed point. This describes the liquid phase. You can have a weak coupling fixed point in which the couplings go to zero. This describes a vapor phase. Or you could have a critical point in which the couplings go to some fixed value, some critical value. This difference in destinations encodes physically different kinds of final behaviors. This is the liquid, this is the vapor, this is the critical point. Each different dimension produces a different kind of critical point. Each different internal symmetry, like the symmetry of the spin, produces a different fixed point, a different behavior. In fact, those are the most relevant things in describing the behavior. Franz Wegener fixed up the mathematics a little bit. He said, let's then imagine that we took the values of the new couplings that came out, the new couplings you want to call H, and they are going to depend on the length scale of the transformation. He says rearrange those new couplings that come out until the transformation produces an eigenvalue. That is, until the new couplings are proportional to the old couplings times length to some power. Those will be, those eigenfunctions are what we're going to use to analyze the system. In fact, he says, why don't we take the conjugate in, that is, why don't we take the Hamiltonian to be H star plus the sum over all possible things of this kind times the local operators which describe these eigenvalues times the coupling constants that describe the eigenvalues. Then with a little bit of elbow grease, a little bit of theory, you see that if the couplings change with an index y, mu refers to the different kinds of couplings, then the local operators will change with an index d minus y, and you have the scaling behavior of everything. Then you can classify the different kinds of operators, the different kinds of things that appear in the theory, the different kinds of couplings. You can have the real part of y bigger than zero. This indicates a coupling that grows as we renormalize the system. The word for such a coupling is relevant, and these couplings must be set to zero if we're going to reach a critical behavior. If the real part of y is less than zero, these couplings will shrink to zero anyhow as we renormalize, so we don't have to worry about them. If the real part of y is equal to zero, we might worry about them, but this exceptional case is something I'm not going to talk about in this lecture. Okay, we want to understand the microscopic behavior near the critical point. I am almost done. We adjust the relevant coupling so the system is near the critical point and they don't appear anymore. We do lots and lots of renormalizations. The irrelevant couplings naturally renormalize themselves to zero. So starting out with some irrelevant couplings and setting the relevant couplings to zero, we reach a fixed point. That fixed point represents a lot of different systems, lots of different values of irrelevant behavior. Each such fixed point represents not an individual system, but a whole class of systems, what is called a universality class, depending on the nature of the eventual fixed point. Each member of a certain universality class has the very same critical behavior. That's what we mean by universality. For example, the Isaac model defines a universality class which relates to single axis ferromagnets in which you could point in one of two directions. It also equally relates to liquid gas phase transition. These two systems have the same kind of behavior. The XY model universality class, representing a rotation in two-dimensional space, is a magnet with an easy plane of magnetization. It's a normal fluid to superfluid transition, since the superfluid has a wave function which has a phase, and that's the same as a sort of rotation in a plane. It also describes, in a way which I can't detail here, the liquid to solid transition in two dimensions. So the renormalization group produces a big change in the way we do things. The old way, we started out with ensembles, that is, with probability distributions, e to the minus beta h, and used those ensembles to calculate averages. The new way is you start out with an ensemble, you calculate new ensembles, and find, after many renormalizations, a fixed point, and then analyze the behavior of the fixed point. In particle physics, which is not on this slide, but I can certainly tell you about, as you do the renormalizations, you calculate what is called a running coupling constant. That is a coupling constant which is appropriate for the scale you're looking at. And you talk about how the coupling constants change with scale. For example, you talk about asymptotic freedom, in which the coupling constants become very weak as you go to short distance scales. Each universality class shows a connection between a microscopic internal symmetry, that is, for example, the Isaac model's up and down symmetry, and the topological properties of a large hunk of space. That is, what we have here is a relationship based on the extended singularity theorem, in which we have the behavior of a huge piece of system described by the fixed point. In particle physics, it is much the same, except we have the behavior down to a very small length scale described by the fixed point. In both cases, what we're doing is describing the relationship between theories at different length scales. In particle physics, we take a theory, we imagine a theory at the unification scale and describe how that produces a theory at the different scale of, say, the Large Hadron Collider. And that tells us how we go from one theory to another. In condensed matter physics, we go from the molecular scale to the macroscopic scale. In both cases, we look at the renormalization group not as a way of dealing with infinities. There are no infinities anyplace in what I talked to you about. Instead, we use the renormalization group as a way of talking about the relationship between theories at different length scales. In fact, physics is all about the relationship between theories at different scales, and the renormalization group produces one of our best ways of talking about that. Mr. Dirac, I claim that this connection between microscopic and microscopic is not only interesting, but quite beautiful. I thank you for coming. Over there.
But does renormalization group theory itself explain why, for example, critical exponents in two dimensions are very often rational?
No. That is, we either use conformal field theory, which does that, or we imagine that there is a underlying theory which has a algebraic structure in which what you're talking about is a relation among probably different Riemann sheets. This is for the next generation of, in one case, the conformal field theory is a way of describing things of the last generation of theorists, or the geometric structure, which I think exists, is for the next generation of theorists. But we don't have that anything, any way of getting that. In terms of geometry, we only have the algebra of conformal field theory, which provides an explanation but is not tremendously transparent.
What is the extended singularity theorem exactly?
That is that if you were to get a singularity in a statistical mechanical system, you need to have a system in which there are correlations over infinite ranges of space. Therefore, you need an infinite system in order to get singularities in the system.
You mentioned the idea of fixed points, but in principle, you might have things like limit cycles. Is there any way in which you could rule such phenomena?
Yes, there is in two dimensions, but I don't know beyond that. In two dimensions, Zamolodchikov has proven that you have a sort of entropy function, which has a decreases as you renormalize, and so you can only go in one direction. only going in one direction kills the possibility of oscillations. The same thing sort of happens in three dimensions, but we don't understand why. We don't have Zamolodchikov's theorem. That is, if you want to have qualitatively different descriptions of a different ranges of field theory problems, you have to have a singularity in the thing, and that requires an infinite range of scales. In field theory, one gets an infinite range of scales by going to short distances. In condensed matter physics, one does it by going to long distances.
So short distances, as it were, short of the Planck scale?
As short as the Planck scale. That is, short of the Planck scale, everything is going to be sort of continuous. There's a technical issue that you're asking about. That technical issue is that we only really know how to do renormalization calculation for systems with rotational invariance, full rotational invariance. So I know how to do an Ising model. It has rotational invariance. I don't know, however, how to do the dynamics of an Ising model because there's a time that differs from the space variables. And most people who look at that say that's a technical problem, that we just we're not clever enough to construct renormalization transformations. I tend not to believe in technical problems. I tend to believe that somehow we have some physics that we've missed, but the next generation will tell us. That you're asking a leading question, and I will of course lead where you're taking me. A droplet has a fractal shape. In fact, there is a theory called SLE for stochastic Lerner evolution, which, in two dimensions at least, constructs by using random walk approaches the ensemble of droplet shapes so that you get fractal droplets and you know the ensemble of droplet boundaries. The idea of fractal is then closely related to the scalings that we use in critical phenomena. And for example, if you want to say so, Mandelbrot is one of the fathers of this subject.
Single transferable vote, I think. Leo's talk, of course, also inspired us and challenged us. As Michael said in his introduction, one of the unusual features of Leo is the fact that his work is known to nearly everyone in Damned, whether we're polytheistic or monotheistic. And, of course, Michael mentioned the work of statistical physics, but Leo's work is really even much broader than that. He's worked on problems ranging from granular physics to fluid mechanics, turbulence, chaos, fractals, you name it. And in terms of inspiring and challenging, he's really reminded us that we should look all around in nature for inspiration for problems that might turn out to be as deep as the ones that he just described today. And he also pointed out the importance of opening our eyes a bit broader than the narrow research discipline